It's 9:40, so if we're approaching 10:40, then we're at the hour mark.
Okay. I can just do the math. It's not really hard for me. So if you want me to help keep track, I can. It's not
I'm
like I'm
just
good.
saying it in my brain. I'm just saying it out loud so it goes in my brain.
Okay.
That's more for me than you.
You do that a lot, and it's okay. It's just sometimes you confuse the other of us that are in front of you. Just a mental note.
Just carry full conversations with myself, so don't even worry about it.
Okay, sounds good.
You hear me in the car. I have arguments with myself. That's even better.
No, I know a lot of people who do this. It's just when they do, like, I know enough people who do this, but then a lot of them do it in front of me. I don't know if I'm just like, I just know a lot of people who are crazy or what. But yeah, Jackie does it all the time, and I'm always like, "What did you just say?" And she's like, "I wasn't talking to you." And I'm like, "Okay, bro, you just said full out loud sentences."
We're gonna call this the beginning of the podcast.
Sounds good.
So welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Ricardo Waliao.
I thought you were gonna say Estevez for some reason. You're from sunny California, and you are Cassidy Launder Robinson. I don't know. I was gonna go some like cold, you know, Norlandic region, but I don't know that language, so it didn't work out so well.
I just made up a Spanish sounding name for you, and you actually
Ricardo isn't a made up name. That's really Richard in Spanish.
I know.
I know you know, but I'm just saying.
Waliao, I'm sure, is probably not though.
No. I doubt it. And you wouldn't pronounce it that way. But that's being pedantic. Let's go on.
You recently guested on Almost Educational.
I did. We did a real life supervillains episode. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think this is their fourth volume of that series.
Right.
And I've been listening to that podcast. In case people are wondering, Almost Educational is Patrick of Make Dad Read Comics. It's his other podcast that he does with a friend of his. It's a school teacher.
A school colleague, yeah. No, it's actually really interesting. I listened to quite a few of the episodes. I usually don't do that. I'm not a,
yeah.
I'm a very bad podcast listener. I like the form. I think it's interesting. I just don't do it. But this one, I don't know why. I think it's because they do something I like, which I refer to as armchair philosophy podcasts.
That's pretty much all of it. Yeah. It reminds me a lot of the type of conversations we have off air.
Yeah.
And a little bit on air.
Well, they also go from a school, like, teacher's perspective.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like it's like sitting in a bar with some of your favorite teachers.
Right. If you got to hear, like, what they would like to talk about in class and don't get to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, so you'll be on it, and it'll be kind of interesting because I always listen to that podcast at work, and I think that's going to air Thursday is when that's going up.
Yeah, he said a week or two. I don't know.
Oh, okay. He might be backlogging then.
He does backlog. I know that for sure, but I don't know. He said he would. I don't know. He asked me if he wanted me to like send the copy and listen to it to make sure I approve of everything. I was like, I don't give a shit. I never do that.
Yeah. For all you know, I could like be, you know, like recording over the top of your voice on this podcast and just being all like, and this is the part where Richard says everything that's wrong. Listen up.
I'd be okay with that. Because, I mean, I know there's enough people that know you're actually the person that's wrong. So it's fine. It's fine. We don't need to get into that, Cassidy. We don't need to get into that. Don't bring it up. Don't bring it up.
I won't. I am going to bring up this weekend, though, because it's Halloween. All Hallows Eve. Are you dressing up?
No, I don't like dressing up. I love everything about the month, but dressing up. It's uncomfortable. I get cold. I don't like having makeup on.
Okay, well, there's lots of things you can do there. Don't wear something that's too breathy or too skimpy. Wear a costume that's already kind of warm.
I have to commit.
You have to commit to wearing, like...
Whatever I wear, it leaves me too warm, too cold, too uncomfortable in some way. And it just, it's a bad idea. It's just, I don't know. I don't enjoy dressing up that much. I like my clothes. If I could go everywhere in my sweatpants and be, like, looked at well by society, I would. I'd wear a sweatpants suit if they'd let me.
Well, nobody's stopping you.
I know. Like, right now.
Like, right this very second. You could wear your onesie. That's sort of a costume.
Oh, you mean my jumpsuit? Yeah. I like that. It's really comfortable.
And it has patches and stuff sewn onto it?
Yeah, serenity patches. Right. When I pretend I'm a space captain. That's not a costume, though. That's preparation.
For when you finally get your own ship.
When Elon Musk comes and knocks on my door and says, Richard, you're the only hope for humanity, and sends me into space, I'll be prepared.
Mm-hmm. And your co-pilot will be a chimp with electrodes in his brain so he can speak English?
Oh, man, that would be great.
Somebody please draw that comic for me.
Just for you personally.
Yes, just a seven-pager. Doesn't have to be really elaborate. I am going to be reprising my costume as the henchman from Venture Brothers.
Oh, you're cheating. Okay.
I'm not cheating.
You can't rewear a costume.
I made the damn thing. I can do what I want.
You did. I will give you credit. You're very good about dressing up.
Yeah, I put a lot of effort into that costume. And here's the thing. It's even harder for me because over the last 10 years or more, whatever I dress up as has to be a fat person. I don't want to like try and be like something cool, like Sub-Zero or Deadpool or something. And just like everyone be the fat Sub-Zero at a party or be the fat Deadpool at a party.
Dude, just do it. Be something you want to be. Don't worry about like that other stuff. Whatever. You're being so self-conscious. No, I was actually supposed to go to a Halloween party on Saturday. But I was sick. I was going to be, it was a Harry Potter. I'm actually really sad we missed it because it looked like it was badass. But it was a Harry Potter themed. And I was going to be Voldemort. And Jackie was going to be my snake.
Oh, man.
But we missed it.
Oh, well.
We have the snake, though, still. It sits on our couch now. It's our couch snake.
I'm sure between now and Saturday, you'll have plenty of other opportunities to do other Halloween-y things.
Well, we're doing Halloween-y stuff anyways. I watched Evil Dead 2 right before we got on here.
I watched our Netflix armor right before I came on here.
Well, that's just normal for you, though.
That is me. Speaking of, today we're going to be reviewing Steve Jobs, which is not very Halloween-y, and A Girl Who Walks Home Alone at Night.
You could dress as Steve Jobs. Why don't you dress as chubby Steve Jobs?
What would that be? I don't
know. I don't know. I have no idea. It'd just be a concept thing. I don't know.
I really want to dress up as Klaus Nomi, but I would be fat Klaus Nomi.
And then, do it.
No, but I mean, it's a weird enough costume as it is. It's basically, I would just become a vinyl triangle with mime makeup on.
I think you're fine. Do it.
I will, damn it.
You're only putting your limits on yourself, Cassidy.
Well, another reason I'm breaking out the henchman costume is because, as I think I mentioned a week or two ago, this Halloween I will actually be at the Stanley's Kamikaze event convention.
Oh, fun.
So it kind of makes sense to be in costume there anyway. Mm-hmm. And I've threatened to wear this costume at other conventions I've been to, but it's always been too hot because that is a warm costume. It's almost all sweats and layers, but now it's kind of cooling off.
Don't you still have a Robin costume somewhere?
Yeah, that thing's come out a lot.
I need to wear it on the weekends, casual right. Fridays.
Yeah, when I need to feel a little more powerful. I just go to work in my Robin costume. I should see what that would have.
Don't even say anything, because when people comment, just look down
and be like,
don't even recognize what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Treat them like they're the crazy ones.
Just give them a weird look.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get into the movie news.
We should do that.
We're not going to do a ton because we have a pet topic today. What did you have?
So when talking about film, I always like to talk about a pedigree, because I think the more good names you have, the higher likelihood it will be a good project. It doesn't guarantee anything. It just ups the statistics.
Right.
So this film, I feel like, has a good pedigree. Doing the script. Well, okay, let's start actually this. Neil Gaiman wrote a book called Fortunately the Milk. It's a children's book, like a picture book, about a dad that goes out to get milk, but then has to stop aliens and all sorts of monsters and mayhem. And it's kind of about the journey. Did he bring back the milk or not?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this book is pretty popular for, you know, kids. And Neil Gaiman's a sort of popular dude. Well, this guy named Brett McKenzie, who's very popular because of Flight of the Conchords, he's going to be adapting the screenplay for this. And then to follow that, who's going to be probably playing the father is Johnny Depp, directed by Edgar Wright. Now, to me, this sounds like an amazing pedigree for a movie.
Yes, it does.
I mean, they're kind of eccentrics, but they're some of the better eccentrics in the world. So I'm pretty much down for this.
What's really interesting about this pedigree is that they're all very eccentric, but they're all very different kinds of eccentric.
True.
Like Edgar Wright is very stylized, and his stuff, you know, his movies always are kind of hinged on the editing and the timing of the comedy, and it's very quick British style witty comedy. But then Brett McKenzie's stuff over from New Zealand and Flight of the Conchords and his movies is a little bit more kind of awkward and sort of about those weird long pauses between the, you know, characters interacting and awkward first encounters and that kind of stuff. And then you have Johnny Depp, whose stuff is all character based. So yeah, we'll see how these three different flavors end up mixing together.
I think they're all tied together by the fact that they're all quirky, though.
Yes, quirky, but
I would say in different styles. I think you're right, but I think it can blend. That can be the common bond if this turns out well.
Yeah,
I mean, this is like super development phase, so who knows? The best directors can make the worst movies, but
I actually think, though, that a person like Edgar Wright is exactly who Johnny Depp needs right now, because his stuff is so formal, and so
well, he wants to be a character. Like, right. I think he just could never put, like, after he was basically after he was what's his face, Jack Sparrow, I don't think he could ever just like, I don't want to be Johnny Depp anymore. It's too fun to be somebody else. Right. I get that. It's just sometimes when you're watching a movie, you're like, come on, just be something. Gosh, you're just being weird.
Right. And he could very well do that here. But I think that, you know, even if I don't think that Edgar Wright is going to just like let him go completely unhinged and just riff and be weird without a purpose.
Unless Edgar Wright is on a bender now. We haven't seen a movie from him for a while. He could just be in a bitter bender.
I think he's doing okay.
I think he is too. I mean, in the next movie he's coming out with is like Baby Driver or something like that. So
yeah. That's actually, I think, like being shot as we speak.
Yeah. It's the only name I know in it really is John Hamm, but it's happening.
My first story, or my only story we're going to do this week, Asia Butterfield, Stanley Tucci, and Jermaine Clement, will be on board for Sam Fell's Croak. And in case anyone wonders, Sam Fell is the same creator who did Paranorman for Leica Studios over in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the story is about a teenage Grim Reaper, and that's who Asia Butterfield's going to be playing. Now, I said before we started recording, I thought it was funny that Asia Butterfield actually came on to replace Cody Scott McPhee.
Oh, yeah, they're the same person.
Who might as well be the same person. I always get them confused, and I usually say one when I mean the other.
Like, I've seen pictures of them, but I'm not convinced that they're different people. I just don't believe it.
Did you ever see that sketch, that SNL sketch? It's a little old, but it's a game show called Dylan McDermott or... Oh, I can't think of the other guy now. Never mind.
So Dylan McDermott versus somebody else? No.
Who may as well be the same person, yeah.
So Dylan McDermott swallowed this other person in your...
In my brain, okay, yeah.
Fair enough.
Oh, Dermot Maroney. Dylan McDermott, no Dermot is. Maroney. He's he was in My Best Friend's Wedding, and he was in About Schmidt.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a guy.
He's a guy, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think, you know, the idea of a teenage Grim Reaper kind of fits along the same lines as what Sam Fell did with Paranorman, I think, where it's going to be about feeling like an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's sort of his thing, based upon these two ideas and kind of working in the realms of, you know, sort of morose, creepy-ish themes, but yeah, wrapped up in a lot of teenage angst.
I don't know. It sounds like it could be good or just schlocky, and I'll just ignore it, and it won't happen in my brain. So, I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not getting any like good vibes or bad vibes from it. Paranorman, I thought was like okay. I thought actually kind of the pacing of that was that movie was a little weird. I had a lot of trouble actually connecting to it. And it should be a movie that I should connect to, like, automatically. Whereas for me, Box Trolls, I was like, yeah, I was that kid that lived with the trolls. And
see, and for me, it was very much the opposite. I really liked Paranorman. I agree that it doesn't, like, 100% work, and it feels a little loosey-goosey in some ways. But I thought that the themes of it were really interesting, and I thought that
some of the themes and some of that stuff, it was...
And the animation was gorgeous.
I just mean as a story overall, I just could. Well, I mean, all of their work is gorgeous.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything that I've been like, oh, like a studio should do better. They should take another 10 years and work on that shit.
I would say that Coraline is still the high watermark.
Oh, well, story-wise and...
Yeah.
I wouldn't say animation necessarily, but just as a complete project. Yeah, you're right.
Okay, and that's what we're going to do for news, because we want to get into our pet topic. Mm-hmm. And I came up with this sort of on the whim a couple days ago, and reaching
you stole it from a quiz night, you told me already.
Yeah, I got the idea from the video round at a Geeks Who Drink quiz last week, but I wanted to have us name three movies each of scary movies that are technically not horror films. So every year we usually do some sort of list of, like, you know, horror films or whatever. And inevitably we always end up kind of like name dropping the classics, whether it be like Poltergeist or Alien or The Shining or whatever. And I think there's a lot of lists out there that are pretty much naming the same movies. So I wanted to kind of think outside the box as far as, you know, movies that freak us out don't necessarily have to be horror movies.
Well, and I mean, that idea is sort of strange to me always, because I've always been a fan of the genre and never actually been that afraid of any of it. It's always just been fun to me. And so people are always like, isn't that creepy? I'm like, no, not really. Not at all, in fact. But I kind of tapped into this. I kind of maybe did it a little different, because I kind of thought of movies that kind of maybe, even though they're not part of the genre, they kind of creep me out. Like,
right.
Like either in their style or something about them. So,
yeah. Why don't you start first? What's your first movie?
Well, one movie that I think is It's part of it, like I said in my introduction, I it's kind of how it's shot. It's got a really gloomy sense to it. Some of the people are really like grating and kind of threatening throughout the whole thing, but it's a comedy. It's Terry Gilliam's Brazil. I actually find some of that movie to be kind of creepy in a way. Okay. I mean, besides the big general themes, like, I mean, if you think about the two plumbers that come into his house and even just like the ending and stuff like that, like the baby masks, it's kind of a creepy movie.
Yeah.
I mean, not to mention that also, like, the anti-authoritarian dystopian stuff kind of always creeps me out anyway, so I actually find this movie, even though I don't consider it horror whatsoever, I do think it's kind of a creepy movie. Also, he does weird things with the camera effects, like fisheye lenses and stuff like that, that really skews your POV.
Right, he definitely is, you know, it's that kind of manic energy that kind of carries over a little bit from Monty Python, but he kind of uses it to a completely different effect here. He does kind of like turn it up, you know, to a higher pitch to where it does become a little bit more threatening. Whereas in like, you know, Flying Circus or in Holy Grail, it's played a little bit more for laughs. Mm-hmm. He kind of changes the tone here, but using the same kind of comedic energy.
Well, also, a spoiler alert, if you haven't seen this movie that was like made like 30 years ago.
You should. You should definitely you see it.
This is my one of my favorite movies anyways. But the ending, specifically how the character escapes his situation, it's a frightening concept. If that's the only way... It's one bleak way to look at things and one bleak interpretation of it, but
right. And it's also one of the most ripped off twist endings of all of cinema.
Well, yeah. And I don't think it was necessarily his originally, but I think he did it so well that people just ripped the hell off of it.
Right.
He should take them all to court.
There was a short story, right? There was a short story I read. I can't remember the name of it. Something at something bridge.
Okay.
Owl something bridge. People who are...
Bridges of Madison County?
No, not that at all. It's a very famous short story that you pretty much have to read in high school or college at some point, and I did. And it basically uses the Brazil ending way before, so I'm sure that was a major influence.
Lovecraft, and there's a bunch of dudes. I mean, even if you look at like 1984, they don't necessarily go full tilt crazy, but they're like, you had all of your like anti-authoritarian, like stick it to the man sentiments. You had it taken away because you were tortured.
Right. Right.
You don't believe that anymore because you were tortured. It was tortured out of you. I mean, it is a scary concept.
That's a good segue to my first pick. Speaking of torture, my first is Salo or the 120 Days of Sodom.
I know a lot of people who do consider that horror.
Yeah, here's the thing. That movie has been embraced, if you will, by the horror community because it is exceedingly unpleasant.
Sure.
However, it isn't a horror film. In fact, I would argue that the reason it's effective and as disturbing as it is because it isn't a horror film. If it were, and it had been shot and played as a horror film, and with, like, you know, dark shadows and, you know, playing up the dramatic tension for thrills, it would have just been, you know, a tortury exploitation movie.
And yeah, it's kind of
run of the mill. But the thing that makes Salo so interesting aesthetically is that there's kind of a like a high level of almost camp to it, because it's an Italian film an Italian art film, sort of, and everybody is dressed to the nines, and there's this beautiful set design that's really ornate in this mansion that they're all these teenagers are being locked in, you know, abused in. And it's shot like in these long, slow tableaus that are just like gushing over the set design. And then you have these actresses who are in, you know, ton of powder makeup and these big bustiers who are dancing around in ballroom gowns while they're talking about the most perverse things you can think of. And it, the whole thing, you know, is, it's treated like this. It's almost like you've been locked in this, theater troupe performing this really insane, dirty, perverse, twisted play for you.
True.
And even the actors who are quote unquote the teenagers are clearly not teenagers. They're like definitely in their 20s. And they all kind of look like they've walked out of like, you know, some modeling agency, because it's an Italian film and it's like actually against the law to be unattractive in a movie.
Yeah.
I'm kidding, but not really.
No. The movie, I love watching Italian movies because, like, man, the people in them are pretty.
And that makes it even really disturbing because, you know, the people, these characters that are being represented are supposed to be teenagers, but they've hired these very attractive, you know, young people to be basically sexually tortured for whatever it is, 120 minutes, maybe. And it, yeah, it's a hard movie to watch, but I think it's a movie that people should see, but it's probably not a movie people will see more than once in their life.
Why should people see it?
A few different reasons. I think it's an interesting cross section between Italian art film and sort of the exploitation world, and like how they, you know, sort of rub shoulders for that one moment. It's also Pierre Pasolini's last film before he was murdered for making it. And he, you know, has a lot of films before that that were highly celebrated. And it's, I think, highly influential. Everyone, I think, you know, from people who are terrible filmmakers like Tom Six, who made the Human Centipede movies, to Lars von Trier, to Michael Haneke, have all been influenced by him and especially that movie.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I would play the devil's advocate a little bit. I haven't seen the movie, but I would say that I don't think that you have to necessarily have the genre trappings for something to be a horror movie. Now, I can't say anything about this movie specifically, but I think sometimes people are a little rigid in their genre allowances.
Sure. I mean, it for all intents and purposes, it could be considered a horror movie in its final effect. I think it's a little bit, it's trying to be a little bit more than that. I think it's trying to be, you know, some people have called it a political satire or a condemnation of capitalism. There's a lot of different theories about what the movie's actually about, but what's your next movie?
Well, I think horror movies can be about all those. My next movie is Chinatown.
Okay.
Again, this goes to kind of some of the thematics I think are in line with similar things to horror movies. Just the blatant nihilism of that movie. Having to talk about just like the spoiler alert again. The ending of this movie is so darkly tragic. It does kind of play out like a horror movie. And there are just scenes in it that are like that. Like I the scene where he cuts his nose. There is something kind of deeply unsettling about that scene. Like, I get more creeped out in that than I do in most horror movies. But I mean, like some of, but even, I was even kind of thinking like some of like the story beats, like even the sex scene is very similar to like a lot of those exploitation movies of that era. I think it's the reason why I kind of like have a weird link into it is because of that. It all came from about the same time, and there wasn't as many like, this is how the genre has to play out. Kind of sentiments, but I find the film overall just dark and very brooding. Even when it's in the sun, in the dark sun, you feel the oppression in it.
Right.
And it's also another one of my favorite movies. So I just there's a lot about this film that I think could be seen as either creepy or as dark, as unsettling, if you really think about it.
Right. It's made by Roman Polanski, who's made a few horror movies in his day, Rosemary's Baby and Repulsion and The Tenant. So he understands how to make something very intense and how to build tension. And that movie is a slow sizzle all the way through. It's very unnerving energy. We talked about it a little bit with when we reviewed Cicero, which has a similar kind of dread that hangs over the whole thing.
Cicero?
Cicero, sorry.
Sicario?
Yes, as it were.
Okay, sorry. I was confused. I was like, "Huh?" Anyway, no, you're right. And there was some. Oh, it left my brain. We're fine. Go on.
Okay, I'll go on to my next one. Harmony Korine's Trash Humpers. I think Harmony Korine thought he was making a comedy when he made this movie.
Well, he was on a lot of drugs, and
Right. Have you seen Trash Humpers?
I haven't. I know more about the person than I do about his early films.
Okay. This is his second to last movie before he made Spring Breakers. Spring Breakers ended up being his probably highest budget, definitely most widely distributed movie.
Probably his most populous movie too, if you could count that.
I mean, as much as he's capable of doing, yes. Trash Humpers is very much the opposite. It was made, I don't even want to guess a budget on this. I'm going to say probably less than 3,000. It's shot on VHS. The basic premise is there's this family, maybe, or gang of weirdos who are wearing these old man, rubber masks that kind of hang on their face. They never take them off. You never actually see what the people underneath them look like. And it's just this collection, I don't know, 70 minutes, 64 minutes, maybe, barely feature length. Just these clips of them doing a kind of like pranks, I guess, through the city. They do hump trash. In trash cans and bushes and bikes and whatever. And they vandalize, and the way I would describe it tonally is it's as if the family from Texas Chainsaw Massacre found a old VHS recording camera from the 80s in a trash dumpster somewhere and decided to do however it is their twisted brains had interpreted Jackass.
That
So the
makes
whole
laugh.
thing feels, I mean, the aesthetic of it is very purposeful, but it has this found quality to it. Like you just found this tape and you're watching it. And I guess it's supposed to be funny, but it really just comes off as deeply twisted and disturbing. And I would say that it overstays its welcome by about 30 minutes or so.
Sure, like a lot of experimental films can.
Right, yeah, it's I don't even know if I'd really even call it a good movie, but it's definitely an experience watching it. And there's something about it that's kind of hypnotic in a strange way, and it is very irritating. Like the characters in it are hard to endure. But there's something about it that it's one of those movies you watch it where you don't, it's not even just that the film is crazy, but you feel like the filmmaker who made it is crazy. And you're never sure if it's going to cross the line.
Well, it might you might not be wrong. No, I mean it's kind of weird because when you hear him now, he's so much more like gathered and so much more like lucent. So yeah. so it's hard to tell. He might have been a little off at that time. My last film. Mm-hmm. It's not really about. It's more just about the first feeling I had when I watched it, and less about anything else.
Okay.
When I was younger, I was really creeped out by Blade Runner the first time I watched it.
Okay.
I found Rutger Hauer's character to be very unsettling, and Daryl Hannah's. I really like that whole thing, and like there's even the scene where they're like the eyeballs and stuff. I don't know. I don't have as much of a... I don't think that it's as much of a... like the ideas are unsettling or anything like that. It's just the overall feeling it gave me. I remember very vividly watching it. I was probably, I don't know, I was pretty young, and it just, there was something about it that just creeped me out. And I still, when I watch it, so there are certain scenes with Rutger Hauer that I can kind of like, where you have that weird, like fade back to a former emotion. Sure. I still have that sometimes when I watch that movie. So I give it to that just for the pure feeling. I don't know if I would necessarily be like, oh, this is dark. I mean, it is kind of a dark movie, but it was more the feeling it gave me more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say the creepiest part in that movie. I saw it later in life, so it didn't bother me as much. I saw it actually in college.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I think I saw it, I don't know, 6 or so years ago. But I thought that the creepiest stuff in that movie is the toy maker guy and his mm-hmm. weird, like, I guess they're little people or whatever, but they're dressed up to look like little android, like, wind-up trinkets.
That's kind of creepy, too, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, a very similar character might even be voiced by the same actor. Reappears in the Batman animated series.
Okay.
In a weird two-parter where an android thinks he, I'm sure it was designed to be this guy now that I'm thinking about it, where an android is convinced he's Batman because he's been programmed with Batman's memories, and then only at the end of the episode does he realize he's an android.
I think I've seen this one.
So. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I get it.
Yeah, but it's more of that thing, that nostalgia kind of watch kind of factor.
Right.
I don't know. I think you are right. I think the toy maker's pretty creepy. I think Rutger Hauer's a little creepy. I think most of any of the robots. So all the people in the movie are a little creepy.
Daryl Hannah as like some weird David Bowie dancing around in a... Yeah.
Yeah.
That. Well, speaking of nostalgia... this one is actually appeared in the video quiz that we were taking, and that is Return to Oz, which I would say of all of the movies listed on my list is the most explicitly a horror film. It was made by Disney, I want to say 1984, 1983 maybe. Stars Fairuza Balk as Dorothy Gale. And it combines a couple of the Frank Elbaum's sequels to Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm. Return to Oz and Ozma of Oz.
Yes.
Those were two of my favorites of his, so.
But unlike the original Wizard of Oz, which is a musical, an MGM musical, and it has its creepy stuff in it too, and you know, that would probably be on a lot of people's lists, for this kind of list. But I think that Return to Oz is so much darker, like explicitly darker. Like the movie begins with Dorothy Gale having to endure shock treatment because she keeps telling people about Oz. And then she ends up going back to an apocalyptic Oz where everything there is trying to kill her for all of the movie, including these creatures called the Wheelers, which, you know, was like some weird steampunk new wave glam rock weird thingies that are rolling around after her. And then you have the witch in this, who her whole concept is she takes people's heads and keeps them in closets and like changes her head. And there's this very disturbing scene where Dorothy's being chased by a headless witch, while all of the heads around her are screaming in their cages. And this was like a quote unquote mainstream Disney film in the mid-80s. Even like the end with the Gnome King like eating the chicken and things like that, just really disturbing.
It's very strange, and they are sort of dark. It's sort of weird because I loved this movie a lot when I was a kid.
Oh, I did too, and still do. But
Yeah, me too.
it is
Yeah.
like
I
it's
just
kind of
watched it a billion
terrifying.
I just watched it a billion times, and so it never struck me that way until I was older, and I was like looking back on it, I was like, oh, this is sort of like even reading those books aren't necessarily. This movie definitely went in a darker direction because neither of those books start out with them like in a like insane asylum and stuff like that. I mean, there are a lot of weird, just personal touches. Whoever decided to make this movie was like, I don't know, in a dark place or something.
Or something, yeah. And you also have, Fairuza Balk, this is the first movie she was ever in. She's like an actual child, unlike
You know her, Judy Garland.
Judy Garland, thank you.
Oh my God.
Unlike her, who was like, probably 25 when she made that movie.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, even just thinking about like one of the her like allies in that film, a pumpkin-headed like scarecrow creation thing.
Right.
Like there's some weird stuff going on. No, I completely understand it, but it's funny because when I was a kid, I was creeped out by Blade Runner, but then this movie, nothing. I just loved it. So I don't know.
I'm not going to say it like kept me up at night or whatever, but it was definitely like this. I remember the first time I saw it, it was like an extended family's house while they were doing whatever, and I'm watching it on HBO or something like that. And I remember it kind of like, I don't know, it just had this weird vibe to it. Like it's very depressive.
Oh yeah, no. It is. There's something oppressive about, especially the post-apocalyptic Oz, like when they get there and stuff. So,
Right.
I think no, I think what you're saying is completely on. I'm more talking from a subjective,
Right, yes.
stance on the movie. I don't know, just everything about it. Like when I was a kid, was just enchanting. So, apparently, that's the Oz I wanted to go to. Because I watched this movie way more than I watched the other Wizard of Oz. So, yeah, I don't know. Again, this is something that says more about me than it does about the actual product. But.
You're probably right. Okay, well, let's get into the real reviews. And we'll start out here, kind of going off subject a little bit, with Danny Boyle's Steve Jobs. And I'll let you set that up.
Okay, so this is a biopic, but it has a very specific way that the movie breaks it down. It breaks it down into three big deliveries or big premieres of one of Steve Jobs' pieces of technologies. And so you see it from different perspectives of his life and of his daughter's life and who he was and what he was really fighting for. It's very much an Aaron Sorkin script.
Yes.
The dialogue is unhumanly quick. And but very intelligent. This film, it's hard not to compare it to The Social Network. I automatically have to go there. I would say that it's very similar, except under somebody like Danny Boyle, it's not as coldly. Just something about Fincher just makes a film more nihilistic.
Sure.
So. This film, I think, has a little bit more of a manic energy and kind of more of a human touch. I feel like you can really see Michael Fassbender, whose performance is incredible as Steve Jobs. Apparently, he said he based it on Ashton Kutcher's performance.
Really?
I think he was
I'm
completely
gonna
joking,
guess
but
yeah, he's joking on that one.
yeah, he was joking, but yeah, he did actually say that. I think the film is pretty good. I wouldn't say it. I don't know if I feel like it's as good as The Social Network, going back to that, but I feel like it's very much in the same vein and in the same ballpark. and in a good way. I think all of the actors are doing some pretty good work here. Kate Winslet is like plays a character, Joanna Hoffman, who is Steve Jobs' work wife, is what she refers to herself as, and she basically just makes him be a grown up. And then there's Seth Rogen, who is like one of the like lead tech guys,
Steve Wozniak. Yeah.
And then Jeff Daniels, who is like a CEO, but kind of a father figure to Michael Fassbender. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is you get to kind of see how his like character flaws, how it built a movement, how it built up to our current time in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me, even though this is about technology, it's sort of like The Social Network, that it's not about technology. It's about us and about our, and while it's a very defining moment of our time, what built up to the moment are these very deeply tragic flaws. And maybe it's something to be said about, like, you know, the massive amount of debt and the horrible housing market and everything else that's kind of happening in our times. But we have this booming, you know, everybody has a cell phone.
Right.
It sort of is very much of its moment. I think overall this is a pretty good film. What did you think?
I would agree with you. I think that if we are comparing it to The Social Network, it doesn't feel quite as lightning in a bottle. It doesn't feel quite as prescient or quite as relevant in some ways. Maybe because that movie said some of the same things a little earlier in a very similar way. But I think this is a good movie, and I think this is full of very good performances. You know, I definitely do think that this is more of an Aaron Sorkin film than a Danny Boyle film.
Agreed.
And I feel that Danny Boyle is kind of sheathing his thing a little bit to service the screenplay, which is so dialogue driven.
Well, I do think what's something that's kind of interesting, though, when you do compare the two, because I couldn't help it. Like, my brain was doing that while I was watching it. That's why I had to bring it up in my review or in my discussion. Mm-hmm. And specifically, what I found interesting, though, is the different energies, because with Mark Zuckerberg in the film, I don't know about real life. Nobody gives a shit about that anyways. it kind of brings this very, his style brings this very cold detachment to the character. Whereas in this, you get to see that manic OCD kind of style of maybe Steve Jobs. So it brings a very different emotion to the man itself, which I found interesting in comparison. Danny Boyle in an interview suggested that Aaron Sorkin should do a trilogy. He should do one more technology trilogy, and he should do it with another really big name in directing. I think this is like speculative, but I think it would be cool if he did do a third film in this kind of a series and did it with like Darren Aronofsky or somebody like that. I think I'm serious. I think it'd be awesome.
It would kind of be. I think a lot of the energy from this movie also comes from the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually not a very short film. It's like a 2:15, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel it really, because the structure is very ambitious, where you have a broke down basically in these three extended set pieces. And they're, you know, they kind of ebb and flow, and they kind of enter into different phases of the set piece that could be broken down kind of like into little scenelets, if you mm-hmm. will. But they are essentially like little mini one acts in and of themselves. And I think that's probably what I enjoyed about the movie the most, was how it was structured, both written and then how it's played out and designed by Danny Boyle.
Well, it's also he also does something interesting in the fact that he shoots it on different film stock throughout. And it brings a strange aging process to the film without having to, you know, like, look at the time, look at the newspaper, look at this. It just inherently kind of clicks in your brain that happens. So I think that he does bring a lot of his more technical side to the film. And he might kind of come at it more of a workman's director almost, in a sense. I still feel like there is sort of his energy there. And I think it brings something very positive to the film. Well, and I think the biggest takeaway, though, isn't necessarily directing, isn't, and the script was basically how I thought it would be. I think the performances are really what does it completely.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about Michael Fassbender's performance here is that we've seen Michael Fassbender do a lot of things, but he's never really played a motor mouth before. He's never really played something where he's had to deliver, you know, pages and pages and pages of dialogue like this. And he's never really played a character as exterior as Steve Jobs is in this movie. What's interesting, you know, originally the part was going to go to Christian Bale. And I see that version of what Bale would have done with this character, because in a way he is a much more external actor. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, he has that new movie that's coming up where he, like, discovers the housing boom or the housing crash, like that's coming out here pretty soon, and he plays, I see the kind of quirky character he would have brought to this. What I think Fassbender brings to this is, while he's delivering all of this dialogue and doing it very well, he has that, you know, he has something in his eyes, he has something in the way he carries himself that, even when he's, you know, talking and talking and talking, implies an interiority. So you get this internal struggle that the character is going through throughout the movie, even as he's, you know, trying to convince everybody of something else. So I think that's, you know, it's a very good performance by Michael Fassbender, and I'm sure he could be nominated for this, and hope he is. It does seem a little like he's outside of his comfort zone. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily in a bad way. And he doesn't really look anything like Steve Jobs, but none of that really matters, because I think he's doing some extraordinary work. Actually, the performance I was the most surprised by was Seth Rogen.
Oh, Seth Rogen was excellent. Yeah. There are specific scenes. There's one in an orchestra pit is the one that I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
That really, he shows a vulnerability in the character that, and also kind of like, there's, it's weird because there's this vulnerable moment between the two characters, and there's this kind of angry moment between the two characters, and it pays off. The film itself is kind of like, it is very much, also very much like Social Network, and that is very influenced by Rashomon. And without the third act, I don't know if I would have liked this film as much, because the way it tied it up was very, the way it tied it up, and it made these characters, their journey, mm-hmm. it made them. But back to performance, sorry, I had to get that out.
No, you're right. I think Seth Rogen is really doing really great work here. And again, he has a very good screenplay helping him.
Well, he has a very good screenplay, but I think he delivers the goods. Like, you could have brought somebody else in here and they could have just delivered it, would have been okay, but there is a vulnerability to the character that I think you don't see in his bro comedies.
No, I mean, also, you've never seen him. We've never seen him, I think, this tied to something as structured as this. And I think he's a good enough actor as it is, that he, structure actually really helps him.
Well, I think this shows something. I think, you know, because we've seen Jonah Hill, I would argue also James Franco, we've seen them be attached to directors with, I mean, we've seen James Franco be attached to Danny Boyle before in 28 Hours. And I think he does something similar. He really brings out a performance in these guys that maybe, and shows that they do have more chops than, you know, probably the general public will ever give them.
Right.
Another actor that I did not talk about before, but I think absolutely is crucial to how good this is Michael Stuhlbarg, mm-hmm. who plays a character named Andy Hertzfeld. And he's another engineer that Steve Jobs kind of talks down to, but he's an integral part of what makes the company, like, work. If he doesn't do his job, then Steve Jobs will look bad. But Steve Jobs still ends up talking down to him, demanding a lot of him. And there's this, again, this crucial moment in the last
act of the film.
Yeah, act of the film is the word I was looking for. That just completely you see their storyline come to a head. And that was another one of my favorite parts in this whole movie. And I've just got to say that I think that his performance, I think is my favorite out of all of them. And that's saying something.
Personally. Right. He's a very, probably one of the more human characters in this film. And one of the more sympathetic characters of the film. And I, you know, he's a really cool actor. I've liked him in basically everything I've seen. He was in the Coen Brothers film, A Serious Man, in case people are wondering if you happen to see that, or I think he plays a reoccurring character in Boardwalk Empire.
He was also in Men in Black 3.
Men in Black 3, and one of the better parts of that movie, actually.
He definitely was. He was this weird thing.
Yeah,
anyway.
Psychic alien thing. Yeah. But he's really good in this. I agree with you on the third act thing. It does tie everything up very well until the last 6 minutes. This thing happens in the movie, and you may or may not agree with me, where him and his daughter go off onto the roof.
But keep going.
Okay. Well, him and his daughter go off on the roof, and all of a sudden they're in a different movie where it feels so studio notes to me, and it feels like the movie completely lost its nerve and somebody came in and said, we got to make this guy a little likable. You've had him be too cold and too impersonal for so long. Just have him say the things that up until this point he would have never said. And I, you know, even though he is a jerk or whatever, I think we've seen glimpses of that thing that scene shoehorns in, enough that it was totally unnecessary, especially that by that point in the movie. I think it's a regrettable landing for this film. I think it's good enough up to that point that I don't dock it too much for it, but I think it is, without it, it would have been a much better film.
I don't agree with you, but that's fine. I think that it works fine within there. And I think that it really, I think for the character, it was a little, I think he needed that moment to be like, yeah, I know. I mean, it wasn't even that he was like, he came to this realization. He's like, no, I know I'm a bad person. Just come back inside. Like, it was more just him kind of coming down. I don't know. To me, it felt fine and it was of a piece. But we'll agree to disagree in this part.
I thought it was incredibly on the nose, and I thought both of those characters were about 5 seconds away from breaking out in a song.
I know it was human and felt warm and fuzzy, so you have a problem with that. I'm just kidding. But no, I'm not. We disagree, and it's fine. Moving on. I think overall it's a pretty good takeaway. If you're especially interested, if you did like The Social Network, I would say see it. And I'd also say if you like watching character pieces in real performance pieces, like where you really see the actors kind of like just chew the scenery.
Yeah.
I think this is a good movie to see that.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a Aaron Sorkin movie through and through. And a lot of his character archetypes that you've seen in his other shows or his other movies are here. You know, you have the Kate Winslet character is playing, you know, the type A, got to keep the male character in perspective, kind of like that character's been in a lot of Aaron Sorkin work. But I think given that, and given the fact that, you know, not everybody loved The Newsroom, I think a lot of people, this is him at his best. And this is him doing what he does really well. And I think that the structure of the film is so interesting and so challenging. You know, I think some people might have a hard time with it because it is so dialogue driven.
See, I didn't feel that at all.
But I was riveted. I think it's, you know, one of the better movies I've seen this
year. See, I was slightly worried what conversation we were going to have here.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't sure. Also, the other thing too is I sometimes when you go to the theater, I don't think you can always trust a reviewer's review. And the reason is because other things inevitably happen in a person's life. I was on like 2 hours of sleep and had a fever and had a cold sweat all through the movie. So I don't know. Like, I was a little worried that it was just like, you know, like that cold brain sweat insanity of a cold. And yeah. I wasn't really seeing the movie for what it was. But now that we talk, I feel a little more comfortable. So I'm glad that it's not just in my head. But I think that this one was, I think it was pretty decent.
Yeah. And right now it's not, you know, it's not doing very well, unfortunately. The last weekend performed badly for everything. Basically, everything took a huge hit this last weekend. For whatever reason, people are not going out to see the movie. However, I think that, you know, this movie's going to stay in the conversation for the next...
I think this movie will come back up around Oscar season.
Yeah, I think for the next few months. Just for
performances alone. Probably screenplay, too. Yeah. I'm not sure about directing. Again, I don't think this is his strongest piece, talking about Danny Boyle.
Right.
But
I think he's very good here, and I think in lesser hands it would have, like, you know, if you'd thrown this in, I don't know, somebody, I don't know, like a Chris Columbus or something, you know, something like that. I don't know.
Paul W.S. Anderson. Did I get the right one?
The guy who did the Resident Evil movies?
Yeah, that one. I think he should do an Aaron Sorkin movie.
I think Aaron Sorkin should write the next Resident Evil.
That would be that would be weird.
That'd be very weird. I think that you know, he's unfortunately not going to be recognized for being able to helm this as steadily as he does, because he is in such service to the screenplay. There are a few moments I am also, you know, gonna say where I feel like he just like is beside himself and wants to put in something of his, and there's these kind of weird ideas of like projecting stuff on the walls behind the characters. It's like, I don't know. I thought that was a little unnecessary style. And then there's some like Dutch angle stuff going on every once in a while that's a little weird. But I think for the most part, he does a really good job of just, you know, singing the screenplay.
Yeah, he does as a technical piece and as just delivering it. I think it's good. But I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think sometimes even directors who are named directors who are, you know, I am the director, the auteur.
Yeah.
They should step aside when there's a good screenplay.
Sure.
I think that there are some people just in their pride or their manicness or craziness, they can't, but good for him for being able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go ahead and move on to the Netflix homework, which I assigned last week. A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night by Anna Lily Amapour, who's an Iranian director. And it's an Iranian cast, but apparently not shot in Iran.
No, shot in California.
This is a black and white film. This only came out last year, but it's shot in digital black and white with a lot of high contrasts. It's a vampire film. And sort of done in a vaguely spaghetti western-ish style.
Vaguely, yes.
Yeah, and some of the setups and visual setups and some of the soundtrack choices and things like that. The basic story, I guess, is that it's this kind of small community of people who live in this town or live in this city. There's this older teenage, maybe 20-something-year-old guy who has a dad who's a drug addict, and he's kind of trying to keep his dad together, and in doing so is sort of wrapped up in, you know, a bunch of gangsters and things like that. And sort of this girl, this mysterious girl who wanders the streets at night, is kind of hovering above it all and trying to take advantage when and she can. When these two characters kind of end up interacting, there's sort of, I thought, sort of sweet, almost John Hughesian romance that buds between the two, which obviously complicates things seeing as how she's a vampire murderer. What did you think of A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night?
It's shot atmospheric and beautifully. I think it should be lauded for that. The problem though that I have with it is I'm almost reacting to the gush because I heard so much about the film beforehand and like, oh man. And I also heard that it was very crazy. I didn't find the film very crazy nor did I find it very strange or anything, or
it's very stylish, but
it's stylish. Yeah. But I feel like it's more style than anything. I didn't get much out of the movie. I the character interactions were interesting. The performances, I actually thought this was this movie also this week, I thought the performances were good, but I didn't really, I don't know. It was just kind of like, okay, stuff happens. Cool. Oh, this is like really, this is like a 1950s vampire movie. Okay, cool. And so I don't know. It didn't really do much for me. And it's not just because it doesn't like really do any genre delivery or anything like that, because basically in the first like 10 minutes, I was like, okay, this isn't going to be like that. I'm okay. And that's not really why. It just felt like a lot of style and like not anything else to really kind of bite my teeth onto. But maybe there's something to do with gender dynamics that I didn't quite place in my first viewing. So I would be interested-ish to go back and see if there's something there with that. I would say that you're right. I didn't think about that comparison, but I thought it was an interesting comparison, the John Hughes kind of Breakfast Club, 16 Candles kind of teenage thing. And honestly, it's delivered better. I find in a lot of films that the love story is usually the most boring part, but in this film, it was kind of the most interesting. I felt like it was a lot of style. And while I think that the style was good, and I thought the performances are good, I don't really know what else I'm supposed to kind of get from it. So,
I kind of agree with you. I would say that the overall effect of the film worked more for me than it did for you. I think that it is maybe a little bit more style than substance. And I think that, you know, some people have read into it more than is probably there. I've heard a lot of people call this a very feminist film. I don't know about that per se. I mean, obviously when you get into, you know, you're talking about the cultural stuff here going on, and maybe I don't know enough about the culture to really say
that was one of my biggest things too, is like I wasn't really sure culturally if it was, because I mean, even reading the synopsis about here on IMDb, it says, in the Iranian ghost town Bad City, a place that reeks of death and loneliness, the townspeople are unaware they are being stalked by a lonesome vampire. Right. And like, you definitely do get that I think the synopsis is good, because it really does have this kind of longing in the movie. And that is something that I did like about it. My overall negative reaction, though, again, it's not necessarily the film itself, but as to the gush, like the people who really loved it. And it's hard not to have that when you get so much feedback on a film before you see it. I tried to give it its day in court, but overall, I know that that's affecting. My personal review.
I think that it's a very stylish movie, and I think that it's a very hip movie, in a lot of ways. You know, there's a very cool soundtrack, and it's shot really cool, and just everything about it kind of exudes cool. And maybe that's fine. I'm kind of okay with that aspect of it. In fact, I think even if that's all it is, even if it's as surfacey as that, I think that it pulls that off really well. And I kind of like just the world this movie takes place in.
Yeah, you're not, everything you're saying, that is all true. I guess I just saw a version of this that the in Vampire Lovers, I think. What was the Jim Jarmusch film?
Only Lovers Left Alive.
There we go, that's it.
Which is really interesting, because the a lot of this style reminded me a lot of Jim Jarmusch, especially his earlier films.
Yeah, agreed. I think it does as well, but I feel like I already saw the better version of this film, and I don't feel like it got as gushed about as much. I personally gushed about it a lot, but...
Yeah, I think both movies are really good, and I think that they're both doing their own thing. And I do recommend this movie, because it's so interesting and it's so cool to look at, and I think the performances are nice. And I think that, you know, even if it is just basically like a 16 Candles-esque kind of love story, I think it's played really well, and I was really surprisingly involved in it. Also has one of my favorite movie cats.
Oh, okay. That's important. It kind of is. I just didn't feel a whole lot of attachment to it. I wouldn't necessarily, if somebody was like, hey, should I check it out? I would say what I said and say that, you know, I thought it was a lot of style, but I do think it's still worth watching.
Yeah.
Or at least to take a look. I guess I would say if you're into certain, if you're into, I don't know, if you're into a certain type of film, I think.
I'd say if you like early Jim Jarmusch, definitely see this.
Like the cigarettes and coffee kind of Jim Jarmusch, sure.
Yeah, or like Dead Man, or what was it? What was the other Down by Law? Like those kind of movies that are a little bit more kind of character centric, but sort of idiosyncratic, and everyone's a little too cool for school.
Mm-hmm.
I think definitely see it if you're into that. Also, if you just want to see a different take on the genre. And actually, you know, this has been kind of a surprising, we've had a lot of these like newer entries in the vampire genre that's really kind of like surprised me on like when I thought I was so done with this genre and we've seen everything we can see from it.
Well, I think that's just the creative
cycle.
Well, it's not just even the cycle. It's also just kind of it's like a challenge. Like I think that there are a lot of creative people and they're like, when people, there's the initial backlash.
Yeah.
And the creatives are like, They might not disagree. Probably Jim Jarmusch isn't like, yeah, Twilight's fucking awesome, you're wrong. Well, maybe he is, I don't know. He's kind of a crazy guy. But specifically, I think there's just kind of like, oh, no, you can still do stuff. This still has validity. And yeah. So they take it as a challenge and try to deliver with it. And I think it is kind of stepping up to the plate and saying, this has been very overexposed. What can we do with it?
Right. Or just take it from a different angle. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, flip it on its head.
But I think that's just kind of a creative. I don't think I sort of like the idea of there being creative cycles. But again, I don't think it's as as big and Campbellian as that. I think it's just like creative people being like, well, wait a second. I think you can. Let's just try this. And they do. And overall, it's been pretty successful.
Right. And I would definitely be into seeing what this director does in the future.
I would be probably more so. I think if she had a little bit more of a budget to kind of deliver on her style a little more, mm-hmm. I think she could make a very interesting film. Because I wondered, because it seemed at times like she wanted to be more visceral than she was being, and she just couldn't. Like there was the scene in the drug dealer's house,
yeah,
where she did go there, and so that's why I was kind of like. It was sort of weird when you saw the next scenes and they weren't as visceral. It was just sort of strange to me, but that's a super nitpick and it didn't really detract from my viewing of the movie. It was just kind of more of a thought.
But mm-hmm. What do you have for us next week?
Okay. I'm going to try the film. It's kind of a horror thriller, psychological thing. It's called The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears.
What?
The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears.
That is a title.
It's a Belgian film. If we're gonna watch a damn foreign horror movie,
okay,
that is a title and you will get, and that's what we're gonna watch. It was either that or Gin, and that doesn't look very good, so we're not gonna do that.
All right, well, we have a few more days left in the month for until Halloween. So even though the next time we'll be recording will technically be in November, yes, this will be the last horror film we decide to talk about for the season. Well, not the last forever, but the last for a little while. So if anybody has anything they have to say about anything we talked about today, whether it was Steve Jobs, or A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, or whatever the hell you just assigned me.
I can't do it now. I just clicked out of it. A Strange Something of the Body's Tears.
Yes, that movie. Or if you want to recall some of the non-horror films that freaked you out, maybe as a kid or as an adult, email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. We will read your email on air, either before or after we do the reviews, depending on how that works out. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Follow us on Twitter at jabberpodcast. You can subscribe to us and please write us a review on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Leave a star rating and a one sentence review. It brings attention, to the site of our podcast and we get promoted more or something to that effect. We're also searchable under, the Zune and Windows Podcast Network, as well as Player FM. We just barely got put on there. So if you prefer to listen to podcasts that way, that is one way you can do it. Read my reviews, that I post weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. That's where I keep all my archives of all the stuff they end up printing in my small town that I don't live in anymore. And you can see some of the content I provided for the Seattle-based website, MacGuffin, at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Richard has a blog called rdwally.weebly.com.
Yeah, just a tiny author thing. It just says, yeah, I do this in my off time.
And Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa have a podcast. They're friends of the podcast. They've been on the show before. I've been on theirs before, called Quarter Life Crisis at quartercrisis.podbean.com. And Brad just started a literary comics / movie reviews / criticism site called Frame and Canvas, I want to say. I don't think I'm saying that right. And I'm a bad person. I wrote a long piece that will eventually be published on that. I don't know. It might have already been. Frame and Panel. That's what it's called. So look that up. And next week I'll have an exact address so that people can actually find it. Listen to our friend Leland's podcast that he does like 3 times a week over in Olympia called dampercast.com, and be sure to listen to Patrick's Almost Educational, which Richard will be on here shortly, and Make Dad Read Comics. But until then, we will talk to you next week.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.